entire staff at the HHS Administration for Children and Families, a division that provides support for child care, family violence prevention, refugee resettlement, and Head Start programs. And President Trump is set to announce a broad package of new tariffs today, escalating tensions with allies and adversaries alike. The new tariffs, coming on what Trump has named Liberation Day, aim to counter what he calls years of unfair trade practices. However, economists warn the move could spark a global trade war and weaken the economy. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer of New York said yesterday the tariffs were a way for Trump to raise revenues in order to pay for his planned extensions of income tax cuts that disproportionately favor millionaires and billionaires. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM.
Hello everyone, I'm Rania Kalik, and this is a special live episode of Dispatches. Israel's genocide in Gaza has ignited a wave of repression that's reverberating across the globe. From bombing Yemen to escalating tensions with Iran, from cracking down on student activists to silencing journalists and human rights defenders, the U.S. and Israel are waging a full-scale assault on dissent. This global crackdown isn't just about Palestine. It's a war on free speech, human rights, and international law. Israel's proxy brown shirts operate across Western countries, targeting those who dare to speak out. In the U.S., international students are being abducted off the streets by ICE for daring to oppose a genocide. Israel's bombing of Lebanon and Syria, along with the ongoing theft of their lands, has been completely normalized. The U.S. continues to fuel endless wars while dismantling civil liberties at home. As this imperial violence intensifies, human rights and international law are teetering on the brink of collapse, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Joining me to discuss this and more is Craig McIver, former director of the New York office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who resigned from his position in protest over the UN's failure to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza. But before we jump into it, this is just part of, But before we jump into it, I want to remind all of you, if you want to support independent media, if you want to support Breakthrough News, where we challenge mainstream propaganda, become a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Your support keeps us going and growing. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this episode to help us get the word out. And now I'm going to bring in Craig. Craig, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure, Rania. Nice to see you.
It's great to see you. I wish it was under better circumstances. So one day we're going to do an episode where all we talk about is how amazing the world is. But that's not today's episode because a lot of dark things are happening. And I'm so happy to have you on to help contextualize a lot of this. And something I want to start with is, you know, You've described Israel's proxy cells in Western countries, if you will, as today's brown shirts, which I thought was a really, really interesting framing. And these brown shirts are harassing human rights defenders, journalists, students, and public figures who speak out against Israeli atrocities. These are groups like Canary Mission, this very fascistic group Beitar, groups like Stand With Us. They have even been responsible, specifically Canary Mission and Beitar, for furnishing the Trump administration with names of students to deport for their essentially pro-human rights views. I had somebody on my show recently, Dr. Lara Sheehy. She described these kinds of groups, and she called them an extension of Israel's occupation, which I thought was another interesting way to put it. But I'm curious if you could maybe elaborate on your framing of these groups, why you see them as fascist, and how Western governments are actively enabling them.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I think this is an extraordinary development in the politics of Western countries, foremost among them the United States, this emergence of these Zionist cells, effectively, that function on behalf of a foreign regime, Israel, but function inside the United States and other Western countries to basically harass human rights defenders and others and to influence U.S. government policy. But the reason I called them brown shirts is what they've emerged into from the historical reference of the brown shirts that were effectively patterned after the black shirts in fascist Italy, but the brown shirts in Nazi Germany that did a lot of the dirty work for the regime. And so if you look at what's happening here now, you have direct collaboration between these neo-fascist, Zionist, I think, hate groups on the one hand, and the government of the United States on the other hand, right? Collaboration with the presidential administration, the Congress, state governments, local police forces, even university administrations, as we know, directly communicating with and collaborating with and furthering the goals of these organizations. And when I say they're fascist, I mean that quite literally. Some of them are followers and adherents to Zionist fascists like Jabotinsky, who was, you know, one of the founders of Israel, the head of the Zionist revisionist movement, which was a deeply terrorist hate group of Zionists targeting Palestinians, founder of the Haganah, which was a violent terrorist organization, was key in the founding of Israel. A lot of these groups are either explicitly or implicitly followers of people like Jabotinsky, later Meir Kahana, another fascist Zionist, who started the Jewish Defense League in the United States and started the Kach movement in Israel, which was even banned by the Israelis for being an overtly fascist party. So they were banned from the Knesset for a period of time. Well, now in Israel, the followers of Jabotinsky and Kahana and people like that are in power, and they also represent the majority of the citizenry in the state of Israel. And so Israel proxy groups in the West are channeling that fascistic ideology in their activities here in the United States and Canada and the UK and Germany and elsewhere, and doing it in direct cooperation with government forces. And that's what's unique. You know, in this country, we had the Ku Klux Klan that was in league with local governments and local police forces, but they never had that level of collaboration at the national level with the federal government here. So this is unique for this kind of a thing, but it wasn't unique in Europe, where that was the model of the Zionist, of the Nazi brown shirts and the Italian fascist black shirts and so on. You know, that's where the historical precedent for these kind of groups lies. But there's something different here too, because the brown shirts in Germany, for example, they were domestic German organization focused on advancing Nazi ideology in Germany, whereas the Zionist brown shirts operate today on behalf of a foreign regime inside of the United States, inside of the UK, inside of Germany, and so on. So they're collaborating directly with the US government and other Western governments and institutions on one side. They're collaborating with the Israeli government on the other side, very directly so. And so they're essentially sitting between the demands of an oppressive regime on one side and U.S. government power on the other thing. And the other thing that I think distinguishes these modern Zionist brown shirts is their funding, right? This is something the KKK could never have dreamed of. These groups are swimming in money from like-minded billionaires and millionaires that allow them to have access to resources give them the access that they need in government as well. So, for example, you have the Zionist billionaire Adelson family, right? Now Miriam Adelson. They funded and organized a multi-million dollar cell that they call the Maccabi Task Force. I don't know if you know about this. It was first focused on college campuses, persecuting students, trying to oppose BDS, which, you know, is a lawful movement against Israeli atrocities. And Miriam Adelson is the head of that organization and its funder, and also is the biggest donor to the Republican Party and the biggest donor to Trump specifically. There's a great interview with Eli Clifton on Electronic Intifada doing an expose on this in particular. And that's only one example of the access to funding that these fascistic groups operating in the U.S. have now. And if you just look at what they've done, right? They organized their movement to advance these Zionist goals through Zionist organizations all across the country. They've corrupted official institutions, either through fear or through favor. Just look at the work of AIPAC and the level of influence that it has in the U.S. Congress, either through massive donations on the one side or through threats on the other side. They organize appointments and election of people that are actually adherents to their ideology. And that's the role that the Adelsons have long played with the U.S. government. You have direct collaboration between the government and fascist movements like Betar, we see now, targeting students and people here on green cards and visas for them to be harassed by official institutions of governance, including law enforcement. They waged a campaign for decades that they're now harvesting the fruit of to equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, which we all know is an absolutely ridiculous statement to make, that somehow criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. And then they took it to the next step and are now equating human rights activism with terrorism, which gives them access to the most repressive laws available on the slate of laws in the US and in other Western countries. And using this, they harass and attack human rights defenders, try to intimidate and silence them, the JDL, Batar, other groups like this. They criminalize this kind of speech. So first they started getting bans passed in government against boycotts of Israel, BDS, and so on. Then the banning and criminalization of student protests, and then everything is next. You know, they've outlawed boycotts. They've outlawed critical speech. They've outlawed peaceful protest if any of this is critical of their political ideology, of the state that they represent. They mobilize the police power to persecute human rights voices. They mobilize media corporations to which they are adjacent to run cover for their activities, to disseminate their propaganda. And now they are literally using the government to abduct people off the streets and spiriting them away to dungeons, all in the name of a single oppressive foreign regime and its violent and racist ideology. That's where we are. And just to stop here, if anyone watching thinks that doesn't matter, just consider this. You can criticize here in the US and in other Western countries, you can criticize any of the 193 countries in the world, including your own government. You can criticize the US as much as you want. But if you criticize Israel, you can be punished, including under the law. And you can criticize any political ideology in the world, from communism to capitalism, democracy, monarchism, socialism, anarchism, Islamism, fascism. You can criticize any political ideology. But if you criticize Zionism, you can be published. You can be punished. So we shouldn't be surprised about this. I tweeted earlier today that political Zionism was always a fascistic movement. And anyone who's read history will know that that is the case going back to Jabotinsky and beyond. But if you know Aimé Césaire, his famous book, Discourse on Colonialism, he says that essentially fascism is colonialism applied at home. So these kinds of abuses were first imposed in colonies like Palestine against the indigenous people. And eventually those are brought back home. And what we are experiencing right now is the fascism of political Zionism being applied here. This vicious colonial ideology of Zionism, after destroying Palestine and destroying Palestinian lives, has been allowed to seep into our own institutions and culture at home. And that was always going to bring fascism here. So official institutions are corrupted by this ideology and by its adherents. Critical speech is criminalized. Human rights defenders are being demonized, police power mobilized to crush all dissent. And that's what we're witnessing today. And this is the root of it, and something that if people don't wake up is going to continue to spread further.
Yeah, and that's a really important point that you say, where we talk about colonialism coming home to roost, fascism coming home to roost. It's really turning inward. And something interesting about this moment, Craig, and there's so many different angles I want to come at this from, but I wanted to get your reaction to the fact that it's all being wrapped up in fighting anti-Semitism. It's all being wrapped up in protecting Jews. I mean, you have today's neo-fascists, the basically like offspring of Nazis, right? Literally using the so-called protection of Jews to commit a genocide, to abduct people off the street and put them in dungeons, and to essentially get rid of our right to free speech in this country, which is an important one in the U.S. It's kind of like a bedrock of the U.S. And I wanted to get your reaction. There's this clip. I'm sure you've already seen it. It's been making the rounds. There's this film called October 8th. That was produced by executive produced by Deborah Messing, who's just a disgusting Zionist, and who thinks she's indigenous to the Levant, which I think is hilarious because she's not. But all that's to say, October 8th tries to, it's a Zionist film. It's very right wing. It tries to frame the protests on college campuses as being essentially Nazi protests, all to make Jews unsafe, right? And so there's this clip of Sheryl Sandberg, who, you know, our lean in feminist, Sheryl Sandberg, former, I think, CFO of Facebook. This is a billionaire. This is a very comfortable woman who is an elite in this society. And I just want to play this clip of Sheryl Sandberg from this film, October 8th, because it's so absurd.
I was on a walk with one of my closest friends who's not Jewish. And just out of nowhere, not expecting to say this, what came out of my mouth was, will you hide me? Like, if it comes to that, will you hide me and my family? And like, do I really think that's going to happen in the United States? No. And it was interesting because she didn't really know what I was talking about. So what do you mean hide you? And I explained that there are these righteous people that hid Jews. This is the story of Anne Frank. And then, of course, she said, oh, I know what you mean. But any Jew would have known what I meant immediately.
Okay, so this absurd victimhood complex that this woman who probably has several yachts she could hide on if she needed to, is just, it's offensive for so many reasons. First of all, there's an actual genocide taking place right now that she supports. She's one of the people who promoted the rape hoax. Yeah. That was like a cornerstone or foundational to justifying the genocide in Gaza for the first year of it, or maybe even more, that some people continue to repeat, despite there being no evidence that there was some mass rape that Hamas carried out across these Israeli towns on October 7th. But moreover, there are medics being summarily executed. There are doctors being abducted and tortured from Gaza. Tens of thousands of children have been intentionally killed. 2 million people, if that's even how many people are left in Gaza, are being starved. And the Israeli government is openly speaking about voluntary migration, which means ethnic cleansing. They are literally raining hell on Gaza. There are students who are mostly Middle Eastern being abducted off the streets for having an opinion against genocide. I mean, no one's talking about hiding them. Their universities certainly aren't going to be hiding them. Many universities have come out and said, like Johns Hopkins, don't even intervene. So sorry, I'm reacting to this now. I want to get your reaction, Craig, because this actually, as hilariously ridiculous as it is, it's also incredibly infuriating.
Yeah, it's hard to know when you see something like that, how much of it is just fascist theater, you know, an effort to, in a very skilled way, circulate a propaganda that inverts reality on its head by making the perpetrators the victims, and the victims, the perpetrators, which is a big part of Hasbara propaganda. It's one of the key techniques that are used. Or how much of it is that she's sincere, which underscores, you know, what I've been saying for a while. You can see how a political ideology, an extreme political ideology like Zionism, that is supremacist in its nature, how that can morph into a mental illness, and that she sincerely feels that because she is disconnected with reality and even with morality by this extreme political ideology that has morphed into a mental illness, and then she's expressing the pain of that mental illness. I don't care. You know, if you ask me, if somebody is defending a genocide, if it's 1933 and somebody is defending the persecution of Jews in Germany, and one of the persecutors says, will you hide me? The answer is no, I won't hide a criminal. I'm going to turn you into the police. So I will hide people who are fleeing the Nazis, just as I will hide people who are fleeing today, the Zionists here. So yeah, it is, she has been a propagandist extraordinaire for the atrocities being perpetrated by the Israeli regime. A big part of me thinks this is just a continuation of that, and she's adding a little bit of theater to the to the mix. But you know, there's always the possibility that it's her own madness is coming out as well. You know, anti-Semitism. I mean, this ruse of anti-Semitism, a very real thing in our society, as you say, Nazis marching in the streets again. But this ruse of the abuse of anti-Semitism, which was an Israeli government strategy that gave us the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism that includes criticism of Israel, is absurd on its face, but they've made a lot of progress in getting official institutions and governments to adopt that so they can persecute human rights defenders who speak out against Israel. And I've said this 100 times before. If criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, then criticism of Iran is Islamophobic, criticism of India is anti-Hindu, criticism of Myanmar is anti-Buddhist, and you can go on and on and on. And if that's not the case, if only criticizing Israel is not allowed, that is a racist proposition, because it means only the Palestinian people, unique in the world, cannot have their human rights defended in a context where Israel is perpetrating war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, genocide, torture, extermination, has broken the world records for the targeting of medical workers and journalists and children. And if I can't criticize that unless I'm an anti-Semite, well, so be it. Call me an anti-Semite. But here's the big news flash for the Zionist propagandists. Nobody falls for that crap anymore. Mm-hmm. Nobody is believing it, because if everybody is an anti-Semite, then nobody is an anti-Semite. And the sad part of that is that they're undercutting the struggle against real anti-Semitism by making it a non-credible accusation in all cases. Every decent human rights defender, the most prominent human rights defenders in human rights organizations, have been smeared as anti-Semites because they dare to call out Israeli apartheid, Israeli genocide, Israeli colonialism, and the racism that is inherent in the political ideology of Zionism. Nobody's falling for that nonsense anymore.
Exactly. I want to turn to another tangentially related part of this, and that is, you know, that something you recently wrote. In my four decades in the international human rights movement, I have seen much cruelty in all corners of the world, but I have never witnessed the kind of unmitigated evil demonstrated today by political Zionism. And you went on to compare this threat to Nazism. You highlighted its impact not only on Palestine, but on Western governments, democratic institutions, the international law itself, some of which you've already talked about on this episode. But I'm curious if you can expand on what makes this moment uniquely dangerous. Like, what distinguishes this current time period in history from other historical atrocities? And I guess, how do you see the collapse of international norms accelerating under the weight of this incredibly dangerous ideology?
Well, I mean, what makes this uniquely dangerous is the power that is now behind it, because it includes the power of the United States government, a global empire unprecedented in the history of the world in its military and economic might, and its ability to touch the lives in horrific ways of people literally in every village across the entire globe. That is unique, to have that level of power aligned with a fascistic, deeply racist, and fundamentally violent political ideology. That is unique. And we're already seeing the impact of that on people's lives. It's not contained in the front lines of Palestine, where people are being genocided, but it has spread into Europe and the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, and to co-opted governments in the global south. It has spread, obviously, across the Arab governments of the region that have been corrupted and co-opted by U.S. power, all aligned in defense of permanent impunity for an oppressive regime in the Middle East, meaning Israel. That is absolutely unique, and we're seeing the danger of it now. You know, in the United States, the U.S. bragging point, always exaggerated, we know, but its main bragging point internationally, it claimed to be the place where free speech was most protected. In other words, you know, the sacred cow of the U.S. government has always been free speech, even as it denied all other human rights. But free speech, it was going to defend. And now it is said there is an exception to free speech. As I said, in our first exchange here. You can criticize any country, any political ideology, but you are not allowed to criticize Israel or its official racist political ideology. And we will crack down on people in this country. We will punish them. We will expel them. We will fire them. We will persecute them. We will sue them. We will kidnap them off the streets. We will lock them in dungeons for the crime of criticizing the Israeli regime or its official political ideology. That is amazing. And connecting this question to the one that you just asked me, you know, you have a situation where the vanguard of the movement against the Israeli atrocities and the Israeli regime in this country has a disproportionate number of Jewish human rights defenders who are participating in that. And they are, you know, just to show that this is not about protecting Jews, they are suffering the same persecution for daring to speak out against Israel and against political Zionism and against U.S. collaboration in Israel's crimes. They are suffering the same persecution. So this has nothing to do with anybody's religion. It has everything to do with the defense of a political ideology that has corrupted official institutions from the federal government all the way down to local university administrations. And they are willing to use force to punish their own people, their own students, their own professors, their own workers, citizens, green card holders, and so on in this country for daring to criticize the regime or its political ideology. I think that is unique in the history of the country.
Yeah, imagine paying $80,000 a year in tuition to a school that basically lets ICE come and take you away to Louisiana and where they literally torture you. It's completely insane. All so that Israel can feel better. So that Zionists can feel better.
It won't stop at permanent residents and lawful people who are lawfully in the country. This, the rhetoric that they are using is building the ground for the next step, which is come after U.S. citizens who have already been come after in other ways, who have been persecuted in other ways, but now to come after them with the force of law enforcement and to start locking people up and saying, well, you opposed the genocide, therefore you are supporting terrorism, therefore we're going to lock you up on terrorism violations. Don't let anyone think that that's not coming and coming very soon if they get away with the persecution of the people who they are targeting now. That is the next logical step, and it's what they're preparing themselves for.
Yeah, I think I saw somebody tweet this. It was a really good way to frame it. It was something like, your status is whatever the closest ICE agent says it is. Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize that because, you know, most U.S. citizens, you don't walk around with paperwork that says you're a citizen. I mean, unless you have your passport on you, and a lot of U.S. citizens don't have passports. So unless you're walking around with your passport, your American passport on you, which you can only have if you're an American citizen, people don't walk around with their birth certificates. Most people don't even know where they keep their birth certificates or where to find their birth certificates. It doesn't say on your driver's license if you're a citizen. Non-citizens have social security numbers. So if people think that they're protected from this authoritarian grab of rights because they're citizens and that they can just wash their hands of people having their student visas or even green cards potentially revoked, you've got another thing coming, because that is the ultimate goal. And so that is the seriousness of what we're seeing with this attack on students at college campuses. And it's really incredible because these supposedly liberal universities, these institutions that the right is always complaining are the liberal elites, are absolutely rolling over to help Trump do this, to literally attack our basic rights to free speech in this country. I want to just emphasize what you're saying about it is at this criminalization of dissent is not going to stay limited to non-citizens. I wanted to ask you, though, in terms of, you know, that's Israel has had this kind of sustained attack on campuses. The groundwork had been being laid for this for quite some time. These organizations like Canary Mission, like Stand With Us, which make lists of people. Canary Mission literally has like websites where they post the photos of students to go after. And again, they've been giving Trump, in addition to Beitar, the names of students to go after. This is part of a years-long effort to lay the groundwork for this. So that's basically a segue into what I want to ask you next, which is about Israel's sustained attack on the UN and international law. Because even before this genocide in Gaza, Israel had been eroding international law by constantly undermining institutions like the UN and attacking them. And you worked within the UN system. So can you talk about that consistent pattern of impunity that you witnessed whenever attempts were made to hold Israel accountable, as well as that years-long effort to really erode and attack the UN? Because we're seeing the consequences of that, I think, play out right now.
Yeah, the UN is very much the focal point. You know, when I started at the UN 33 years ago or whatever it was, 34 years ago, it was a different UN. You know, that was before Oslo. That was before this kind of implicit suspension of international law when dealing with Israel, where the message was, don't focus on international law or the rights of the Palestinians. There is this political process called Oslo, and everything needs to be resolved there. And the U.S. are one of the key mediators. And so what Israel's closest ally, Armor, and the mediator said would go. And that started to corrupt the way the U.N. did business over that 30-year period of Oslo, because up until that point, the U.N. was very focused on the rights of the Palestinian people, on anti-colonialism as a principle, self-determination as a principle, Zionism as a form of racism, as a principle adopted in a UN resolution in the 1970s, the right of people under foreign occupation or colonial domination to resist, including with the use of armed force. That was the UN pre-Oslo. Oslo began a process of distortion. And what happened, and remember, the UN is not afraid of Israel. What the UN is afraid of is the United States, the UK, and Germany, whose foreign policy, including its multilateral foreign policies, are built around Israeli impunity because of their own domestic political processes. And so they bring the massive pressure and power that they have inside the UN. They bring that pressure and power to bear on the Secretary General, on the High Commissioner for Human Rights, on the Budget Committee of the organization, in order to try to silence it whenever it tries to do the right thing. Now, there's another UN. There's the UN, which is the independent human rights mechanisms of the UN, like the Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, or the Commission of Inquiry headed by Navi Pillay, or the other thematic rapporteurs, or the treaty bodies, and so on. They have been uncompromised and uncompromising in their application of international law to protect the rights of the Palestinian people and to demand accountability for the Israeli perpetrator. But in the political corridors, they've been very much corrupted. And one of the things that's changed, we talk about these brown shirt organizations, is that, you know, when I started, there was no such thing as an Israel lobby in there were some, like, you know, Zionist women's organizations and so, but they didn't have any influence. And what happened there is, starting with the U.S. ambassador, because, you know, U.S. ambassadors to the U.N. are always selected principally based upon their commitment to Israeli impunity. And if you doubt that, watch the confirmation hearings in the Senate of every proposed U.S. ambassador, including most recently Elise Stefanik, who's been pulled, but she went through that process.
She's insane.
And you will see, going back decades and decades, Republican-Democrat appointments, that the U.N. ambassadors are picked principally based upon their allegiance to Israeli impunity. And that was the case back then. There was a guy called Morris Abram, who was an Israel lobbyist, who became the ambassador in Geneva, which is where the human rights mechanisms were. And as he was on the way out the door, he set up an Israel lobby group, really a Zionist harassment group, that would focus its energies entirely on the UN to attack UN human rights defenders and UN officials. I was attacked by them many times in my career in organized campaigns in order to silence them and to try to distort processes in the UN. And over time, that influence increased. Didn't exist when I started, but by the time I left, you know, they had a lot of resources, and they were wreaking a lot of havoc inside the UN organization. And they are networked with other organizations. So that, you know, one Geneva-based organization worked with, like, UK Lawyers for Human Rights, and presumably the I think U.S.-based Nasher Jew is this group of trolls that are together and so on, and they can create a lot of trouble. But they also work hand in hand with the U.S. mission to the UN on attacking people inside the UN trying to stop. So now you'll see, you know, I mean, it's outrageous. You never would have seen this when I started at the UN. An independent special rapporteur mandated by the UN Human Rights Council will criticize an Israeli atrocity that occurs, and then will be publicly attacked by the U.S. ambassador, who will also tweet about, you know, smearing and slandering the person as they do it. So that the UN has gone through a very difficult period. Now you look at this year and a half almost of the current upsurge in genocidal attacks by the Israelis in Gaza and in the West Bank and beyond, and you look at the way the UN has responded, and you see the impact of that. The Secretary General has never even uttered the word genocide. He launders all of his speech on the subject to do a both sides kind of equivalency between occupier and occupied, colonizer and colonized, oppressor and oppressed. He will use every extreme adjective to describe what Hamas does or what any other government does when they're involved in atrocities, but he will never use those adjectives with the Israelis, who he frequently won't even name. He will lament the deaths that happened, but he will never condemn the murderers when it comes to Israel, where he will in other situations, from Ukraine to Sudan and elsewhere. That's the impact. And they will come to you, you know, and they'll say, okay, High Commissioner for Human Rights or whoever you are, you know, we don't like what you or this official said about one of these Israeli massacres. You need to back off, because when time comes for the budget committee, we're going to remember, and good luck on getting the funding that you need for your anti-racism program or your right to health program or whatever the case may be. The most important thing for people watching this to know is that there is enormous pressure on actors within the UN to do the wrong thing when it comes to Israel, to protect Israeli impunity and to throw the Palestinians under the bus. The only thing that can counter that is more pressure from the human rights defenders in the world to make sure that the Secretary General, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the heads of the agencies and departments, the member states of the UN feel more pressure to do the right thing than they're getting from Israel, from its Western allies, and from its lobby groups to do the wrong thing.
It's really incredible, because at this point, I mean, I think that Israel could actually put Palestinians in gas chambers.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody would still be like, Israel has a right to defend itself. And anyone who criticizes this is anti-Semitic, and but Hamas, like, because of all of this disgusting pressure and the opportunism and really the lack of spine that apparently too many people lack, like a spine. It's just, it's really an upsetting moment for our collective humanity. However, there are forces who have tried to intervene. And interestingly enough, it's been the poorest forces in the world. And I mean, I know you've made this argument before. You've talked about it on this show before. We actually had you on our weekly live stream, The Freedom Side, to talk specifically with regard to Yemen and Yemen's right to intervene against genocide, and that they're actually in the right, while those who are attacking Yemen are the ones in the wrong. But I think it's worth emphasizing a million times, because all these people, all these very, very comfortable people who are unwilling to put anything on the line to oppose the most horrific thing we've witnessed in our lifetimes. Yet there's these people who live in complete discomfort, who live in deprivation in places like Yemen, in places like Lebanon, Palestinians themselves who have tried to intervene and they've failed to stop it, but nonetheless, they've intervened. So I'm curious if you can talk about the fact that we have this all backwards, the way it's covered is backwards. Yemen's accused of carrying out acts of terrorism, but actually it's the other way around.
Yeah. You know, I said before that, like one of the lessons that I learned from 40 plus years in the international human rights movement and traveling all around the world in solidarity with people is that it is often those who have been the most oppressed who have the strongest sense of justice. And it's often those who've been the most deprived that have the strongest sort of generosity spirit. And the Yemeni people have been through an absolutely genocidal campaign by Saudi Arabia and the Americans and the Brits and others, and the siege going back for a very long time. They have suffered greatly, and they feel a very strong sense of solidarity with the Palestinians because of what they are enduring. But what I said about this is that the U.S. is bombing Yemen because Yemen is acting as required by international law to stop the genocide and the unlawful siege in Palestine. That's why the U.S. is bombing Israel. You won't hear that from Western media corporations. You won't hear it from perpetrator governments like the U.S., but it's the truth. And you don't have to, you know, be a Houthi or a supporter of Ansar Allah generally to recognize it's just a fact. You know, Ansar Allah doesn't share my politics or my worldview. I'm not, I don't share their religious view. I don't just share their political view. But right. What they do here is the right thing. And you know, the distortions that you see on this in the U.S. media, which I force myself to watch, the way you explain it is because there's a genocide being perpetrated in plain sight. So you have to suppress the truth and you have to obscure the law in order to allow that to go forward. But in this case, you've got the International Court of Justice, and please stop me if I get too legalistic. I feel like the last time we spoke about this, but you have the International Court of Justice, and the United Nations General Assembly in an extraordinary resolution, both affirming that all states are obliged to cut off all military and all economic support for the Israeli regime's occupation of the Gaza and West Bank, including Jerusalem, and for its genocidal assault on the people of occupied Gaza. That's international law. And it's not just international law. Those findings are rooted in the highest level rules of international law, right? They're called, jus cogens and erga omnes rules of international law. They include, you know, the prohibition of genocide, prohibition of aggression, prohibition of acquiring territory by force, violating the right to self-determination. These are the highest rules in international law, right? And they bind all states. They bind the Yemenis and they bind the Americans, for example. Houthi Yemen has acted in concrete terms to meet those obligations by imposing a blockade on ships that were destined to resupply the Israeli regime at the Red Sea port of Eilat, and explicitly doing so, and they said explicitly we're doing this in response to the Israeli siege and genocide in Palestine. So now you've got Yemen being ruthlessly bombed, this poor, tortured country being ruthlessly bombed by the U.S., killing civilians in the process, simply to ensure Israeli impunity for continued commission of crimes in Palestine. And that means that the lawless country here is the United States. It's in breach of the legal findings of the International Court of Justice. It's guilty of two separate crimes. It's committing aggression, which is considered the supreme crime under international law, and it's committing the crime of complicity in genocide in doing so, right? The Yemenis are being the human rights defenders here. This is a humanitarian intervention. There's no other way to look at it. So the good guy, bad guy narrative in the U.S. government and its media corporations that are so obsequious, that's a direct inversion of the truth in the way that they have been presenting it. And I don't think there's any way around. Those are the facts. Yeah. And you have to really test the lies that you'll hear in the U.S. media or from the U.S. government on these issues, trying to find a justification for this. Their only justification is that they will use, false justification, is because they're protecting commerce. Well, the protection of commerce does not rise anywhere near the level in international law to these jus cogens and erga omnes obligations that relate to stopping genocide, protecting self-determination, and the other issues that frame Palestine in the current moment. So I don't see how else you can look at it other than to say that in this case, you know, it's the Houthis are on the right side in Yemen and the Americans are on the wrong side.
You know, and then we can expand on that a bit, because in many ways, you know, what Israel has normalized with Gaza and with Lebanon and Syria as well, is this situation where, like, even when there's no resistance, they are claiming the right to bomb, kill, steal. Obviously, since the ceasefire in Lebanon in November, Hezbollah hasn't fired a single shot at the Israelis. The Israelis are now regularly, it seems, bombing South Beirut. They've been bombing the South throughout the entire ceasefire. There's been over 1,000 ceasefire violations. A handful of rockets were fired at Israel and intercepted in this time. Nobody even knows by who. Many people suspect it's actually like the Israelis or their proxies themselves. Syria has not fired a single shot at the Israelis. There's actually a government that would like to eventually normalize with Syria or with Israel now in Syria. Yet the Israelis continue their aggression. They continue their land theft. They continue killing people. And in Palestine, I mean, Hamas has abided by this ceasefire and Israel has continued to destroy and bomb Gaza and is now actively trying to ethnically cleanse everybody and kill everybody again in the more ferocious way than even before. And all that's to say they've created this or they've normalized a situation where might equals right. And that, you know, and Trump is doing this as well around the world. But it's like you either completely submit to everything and more that we are demanding or we'll destroy you. But also, even if you submit, we will still destroy you. And that's all to say now it's coming for Iran. And it's funny because, you know, the way Iran is framed is that Iran's the big, bad, evil country because, you know, they fund terrorists and arm terrorists across the region when, yeah, Iran arms and funds partners across the region that fight Israel and defend their sovereignty that the Americans label terrorists. But all that's to say, this is coming for Iran. Trump has recently threatened Iran. And I kind of just wanted to ask you, like, it seems to me we're at a higher risk than ever to see a U.S.-Iran confrontation. And I maybe this is a, I'll put it in this broader question, too. It's like, what's at stake here? Because if Israel continues to get away with what they're doing in Gaza, if the U.S. gets away with what they're doing in Yemen and everywhere in the world, and nothing is done to stop these monsters, what kind of world are we looking at? Because we're looking at the prospect of a war with Iran, but I think that's just the beginning.
Yeah, unquestionably. I mean, what we're seeing played out here now is the whole logic of international human rights law, international humanitarian law, international criminal law, built up over the course of the last 80 years, has been that if you allow impunity for a perpetrator regime, that will cause the abuses to spread and to spread and to spread. And there is no country like Israel that has been granted and had its impunity defended by powerful states like the US for so long in the post-war history. And that has emboldened and empowered Israel to continue its bloody reign of terror in not just in Palestine, but in the broader region, and to expand it and to expand it and to expand it. Israel is an annihilatory regime. Its very purpose is to annihilate the indigenous people of the region because it believes that its security comes from the destruction of anyone who might oppose it. And that's why it has always been a genocidal entity in Palestine, because you can't have a Jewish supremacist state in a place where you have first a majority, still a majority, by the way, if you count those forced into the diaspora of Palestinians, or even a significant minority. And that means periodic ethnic cleansing becomes necessary, and periodically, 1947, 1948, and then 2023, 2024, 2025, expedited genocide in order to purge large amounts of the indigenous population. And the same logic is then applied to neighboring countries, right? Israel will never be big enough as long as its neighbors do not support its annihilatory project. So you have to destroy and occupy repeatedly Lebanese territory, Syrian territory, for a long time, obviously Egyptian territory, and you have to keep the pressure on any country in the region that has not been counted. I mean, just look at the march of U.S. empire on behalf of Israel and on behalf of oil, obviously, and other geopolitical interests, decade after decade, and you see one by one, any indigenous government in the Middle East that wasn't under the command of the American government, if it couldn't be co-opted, would be crushed one by one by one. And who is left standing now? Yemen, half of Yemen, half of Lebanon, right? Because Lebanon is divided in this respect. Syria has just fallen to those interests as well. And you've got Iran, not an Arab country, but a country in the region and a very powerful one. And the ones with the most power are the ones who are always going to be the targets. It's why Iraq was targeted. It's why Egypt was targeted. You know, Syria was targeted. One by one, any resistance has to be completely crushed, because the only purpose of an annihilatory regime like the Zionist regime in Israel is its own dominance, its own survival and existence in that area. So that impunity has allowed this to spread and spread. You know, when they carried out a mass transnational terror attack in Lebanon with explosive pagers, which was like one of the biggest terror attacks in modern history, or maybe in the history of the world, if you think in terms of its reach, and they were allowed to get away with that, that was another signal that there is nothing. International law does not apply to us. There's nothing we can't do, because the reality of the world is that you've got powerful states like the U.S. that will never let us be held accountable, that will not only protect our impunity, but will arm us in our crimes repeatedly, will fund us, will deny the funding of its own people's needs for healthcare and other things in order to channel billions and billions and billions every year, consistently, year after year, decade after decade, to this small oppressive regime in the heart of the Middle East. And we're witnessing, you know, the culmination of that decade long, you know, 80 year plus project now. And it's very dangerous, because it's reaching the point now where there are two possibilities. One is an all out war with Iran and resistance groups being involved around the region, that will ultimately come back to touch the homeland as well. People think that if you think that you can go every day to somebody's house and, you know, and assault their daughter and assault their wife and assault their husband and assault their father and tear up and burn down their house and go back and back and back, and nobody's ever going to hit you back, then you have not been living on the earth at all. I mean, ultimately, that is going to happen, or you're going to see a massive reaction from a powerful government in Iran that has capacities that are not comparable to any other of the regimes in the region. Or at the end of that, you're going to see basically a regional level genocide perpetrated by Israel with the support of its Western sponsors. So we've reaching the culmination of that project is a point of danger for the entire globe, certainly for the region, but beyond the region as well. And you know, the U.S. should also think about this. You know, they are spending whatever international capital they had. I don't mean money here, but I mean political capital. They are spending it in droves in defense of an oppressive foreign regime that the whole world knows is an oppressive, racist, violent regime, a genocidal regime, and it's not going to get that capital back very quickly. In a moment when the U.S. star is declining, the empire is becoming weaker and weaker with the passage of time. Other powers are rising, other geopolitical coalitions are being built. You know, the unipolar moment of absolute U.S. imperialism is ending, and yet it's wasting whatever capital, diplomatic and political capital it has in the world, on behalf of another country, on behalf of a foreign regime that is pretty universally despised outside of the elite corridors of Western governments. We're heading into a very dangerous moment. I don't see any sensible people in the Trump administration are in a position or are willing or have the right incentives to put the brakes on this process. Israel has been working for decades to get the U.S. to go to war with Iran on its behalf, and they are just giggling in glee now that they have a crazy enough administration in place where it might actually happen.
Yeah, it really does seem to be going in that direction. And, you know, something you said recently or that you wrote on Twitter was you said, you have known all along, your silence is your crime. And you were talking about, obviously, the silence over what's happening in Gaza and everything attached to it. I guess, can you speak to that moral burden of silence and how complicity through inaction is enabling this genocide? And also, I guess I would add to that, Craig, like, what does meaningful action look like at this stage? Because I think people are having a hard time understanding that, but specifically to those who have remained silent.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. You know, we all grew up reading the history books of, you know, the march of fascism and Nazism, and how so many people just remained silent, some out of, you know, because they didn't care, others because they were afraid, others because they thought they had nothing to lose. And then the question is always, what would you have done during Nazism in Germany? What would you have done during Jim Crow in the United States? What would you have done during apartheid in South Africa? And people always just say, well, I would have spoken up. I would not have tolerated that. But what we see is that the masses of people, I mean, first, not to belittle the global upsurge in solidarity and the really principled and courageous activism of millions of people in the US, in the UK and Germany, you know, in the bellies of the beasts that are responsible for this genocide, standing up and saying no. And not to belittle the global solidarity that has revealed that most countries in the world and the vast majority of the people in the world stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. No question about it. But in these places, these perpetrators...
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Trump proclaimed today as Liberation Day in the United States as he prepares to impose sweeping new tariffs that would escalate a trade war with global partners, increase prices, and upend a decades-old trade order. A broad package of new tariffs are expected to be announced at a White House Rose Garden ceremony today, scheduled for 4 p.m. Trump says the tariffs will counter what he calls years of unfair trade practices. Senate Democrat leader Chuck Schumer of New York said yesterday the tariffs were a way for Trump to raise revenues in order to pay for his planned extensions of income tax cuts that disproportionately favor millionaires and billionaires. In other news, Israel announced a major expansion of its military operation in Gaza today, one that will involve seizing large areas of land from the Palestinians. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said the operation will involve a large-scale evacuation of Gaza's population, after which time these areas will be incorporated into Israel's security zones. The announcement followed a night of intensive airstrikes on Khan Yunis and Rafah in southern Gaza, which hospital officials said had killed at least 21 people. Since breaking the two-month-old ceasefire with Hamas 2 weeks ago, Israel has resumed its attacks on Gaza, killing hundreds of Palestinians, according to officials in the enclave. Israel has also continued to block humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, and the UN has warned that food supplies are running out. In more domestic news, a liberal won Wisconsin's Supreme Court election, while two Florida Republicans won their special elections to fill U.S. House vacancies. In Wisconsin, liberal Susan Crawford defeated conservative Brad Schimmel, despite billionaire Elon Musk pouring about $20 million into a campaign to oppose her. Her victory offers a warning sign for Republicans that Musk could damage their advantage in other key elections. In Florida, voters selected Republicans Jimmy Patronis and Randy Fine to replace former Representatives Matt Gaetz and Mike Waltz. However, in another warning sign for the GOP, the margins of victory for Patronis and Fine in the deeply red districts were about half of the margins for Waltz and Gaetz just 5 months earlier. And a federal judge today formally dismissed the corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. The order from U.S. Judge Dale Ho brings to an end the case against Adams, who had pleaded not guilty to conspiracy, bribery, wire fraud, and other charges following his indictment last year. In granting the controversial request from the Justice Department, Judge Ho said he had little choice but to dismiss the indictment because U.S. courts lack the authority to compel prosecutors to pursue charges. But he said the Justice Department's decision to seek dismissal of the charges was troubling because an individual's criminal liability should not depend on whether they support the administration's policies. Judge Ho wrote, quote, "Everything here smacks of